From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, Congressman John Conyers talks about Detroit's water shutoff crisis and its impact on the poor.
This is not an appeal for them to get free water.
People who endured the Enbridge 6B oil pipeline on their property may be in for an unhappy encore, a proposed natural gas pipeline.
It's going to be the very same people, the very same route, the people who saw their backyards torn up for a year.
Plus, science fiction lovers flock to Detroit this week.
A convention center full of authors and fans and basically just a hotel packed full of geeks.
Those stories and more today for you on Stateside. Michigan spends nearly $2 billion a year on corrections. And Michigan keeps its prisoners behind bars longer than the national average. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today on Stateside, is there a better way to operate prisons? We look at what countries like Germany and the Netherlands are doing to reduce the number of reoffenders and get inmates back home faster. Then people who endured the Enbridge 6B oil pipeline on their property could be in for an unhappy encore, a proposed natural gas pipeline. Later this hour, we get an update on this proposed Rover pipeline. But first, Michigan's legislators are taking a break from their summer break. They'll be back in Lansing tomorrow. The day will bring committee meetings, including attention to a pair of bills dealing with medical marijuana. Jake Neer is the Lansing reporter for the Michigan Public Radio Network. Jake, is it unusual for these occasional summer session days to actually see possible votes on something?
It seems like this is one of those days where they come back out of their summer break, and it's more than you'd expect for them to do. A lot of the time, they just have these dates set up just in case they have unfinished business that they want to come back and do. But we're actually going to see a number of committees coming back together to get some work done over the summer, maybe to try to set some stuff up for the fall, and especially after the August primary.
What about these medical marijuana bills that apparently are much more on Senate Majority Leader Randy Richardville's radar screen than they were in the past?
Yeah, this is really amazing how the path that these two bills have taken through the legislature. First of all, the first bill would basically allow medical marijuana dispensaries in Michigan again. A few years ago, after the Medical Marijuana Act was passed, there were dispensaries, and then a lot of those were forced to shut down after some court rulings that said that they could be a public nuisance and so forth. This would basically allow local communities to say whether or not they want them and then regulate them in a certain way. So we could see some of those dispensaries coming back. Another one would change the Medical Marijuana Act to allow patients to use edible or other non-smokable forms of medical marijuana. And in the House, this was referred to a committee where a lot of people thought it would be dead. The House Judiciary Committee Chair Kevin Cotter was not a fan of these bills when they came to his committee. And then through the lobbying effort on the part of medical marijuana advocates, his mind was changed and he became a proponent of the bills, basically. And same thing here in the Senate. Senate Majority Leader Randy Richardville came out and said, I'm not interested in expanding, as he put it, the Medical Marijuana Act and allowing dispensaries to operate again in Michigan. And now it's almost the same thing after months of, speaking with the medical marijuana community. It seems like, his views have changed drastically. Now he's in support of these bills.
Do you think these bills would be voted on at all, do you think, tomorrow?
They'll be voted on committee, but not in the full Senate.
Okay. Now there's some committee work happening, and we know that a lot of drivers in Michigan weren't especially happy with their lawmakers when they broke for the summer without coming up with a long-term solution to fix our crummy roads. Will there be anything happening on that front tomorrow when they meet?
You know what I'm hearing right now, there's not going to be any movement, at least in the Senate, on roads, and that's really where the conversation is right now in the Senate. So don't expect to see much on that front. It's sort of in my mind like when they set up the orange barrels in the street, and then you never see workers, and it's just taking up half the street. I feel like that's a similar frustration with this with the legislation for a lot of supporters of boosting road funding in the state.
Jake, any other things that might be looked at or dealt with when lawmakers get together tomorrow?
Well, there's a couple of smaller things. For one thing, one thing that really caught my eye is the lawmakers are looking at maybe trying to set up an early warning system for deficit school districts, and that's the bills that would try to do that are coming up in committee tomorrow, basically trying to make sure that more school districts don't get into financial trouble. And although if they do, these bills could make it easier for the state to appoint an emergency manager for districts. Another one is that there's a bill coming up in committee that would ease driver responsibility fees. In other words, people who still owe money on tickets for driving without a license or proof of insurance from before September 30th could do community service instead of having to pay the fine, basically.
So getting things teed up for when they all come back in the fall.
And we'll also see what bills get introduced to. That could be interesting as well.
We'll be checking in. Jagnir Lansing, reporter for the Michigan Public Radio Network. Thanks, Jake.
Thank you, Cindy.
Detroit's vigorous effort to collect some $90 million in unpaid water bills has resulted in water being shut off to thousands. That's drawn angry attention from the United Nations and also from my next guest. Congressman John Conyers calls this a human rights issue. Congressman Conyers is with us now from Washington. Welcome.
Pleasure to be with you, Ms. Canty.
Congressman, you wrote a letter to President Obama on June 26th, and as I read it, exploring the water crisis, you really spelled out why you think so many people are behind on their bills and also the problems Detroit has had in keeping its water system maintained, especially from scrappers. Would you talk to us a little more about what you see as the causes of this crisis?
Yeah, the fact of the matter is that we've been going through an economic situation that highlights the problems of the whole country, and much of it has to do with deindustrialization. It has to do with higher unemployment rates than anywhere else, mostly. And the fact that we're going through a period of time where many families are adding to the inability to pay list that is getting larger and larger with the Detroit Water Works Department.
Congressman Conyers, in your letter, you asked President Obama for money from Michigan's share of the hardest hit fund, and that was the fund set up in 2010 by the Treasury to provide targeted aid to states that were hit hardest by the Great Recession. And you note in your letter that Michigan has drawn down just 41% of its total hardest hit allocation of more than $498 million. How would you like to see hardest hit money help with Detroit's water crisis?
Well, we'd like our experts to come in and evaluate, depending on how much money we need and how much money we get, to in a very professional way allocate the money to keep us going strong. What I'm afraid of...
When you say keep us going strong, sir, what do you mean by that? What particularly would you want that money to be used for?
Well, for the necessary repairs and upkeep of the pipes and other systemic issues that may require some attention in the Department of Water.
But, Congressman, I do have to ask, shouldn't a city that's in bankruptcy take every step possible to get the money back when it's owed them?
Oh, absolutely. I don't mind there being a strict accounting of how much people owe, and that all of that is fine. The problem is, though, that they're talking about increasing shutoffs as a method of reducing the indebtedness that is owed to the water department. But that's counterproductive. If we have an outbreak of disease, or if some illness strikes the area because of lack of water, we'll end up with a health bill, a clinical and hospital costs that would even exceed the amount of money that's owed. And by the way, the Department of Water has had a 119% increase in the cost of water over the last decade.
The activist group, Congressman, like the Detroit Water Brigade and the Blue Planet Project, say that the city is zeroing in on the poor and on these seniors, while the big-name business and government customers are not being hit. In fact, the state of Michigan owes $5 million. What's your take on this?
Well, it's absolutely accurate. Now, the large corporations and the public entities that haven't been paying their water bill, as soon as that becomes public, they can write a check and resolve their differences immediately. They have the money. And, of course, I'm not talking about people that can afford to pay their water bill and aren't paying it. I don't include them in the appeal to keep water going to every household. But when you've got nearly half the households in the city in poverty, it isn't hard to figure out that many of them, some of them, cannot legitimately afford to pay their water bill. And that's where we have to have a little humanity, a little charity, and a little insight. This is not an appeal for them to get free water. I think everybody that gets water should get a bill and should be held accountable for it. But increasing the amount of water shutoffs is not a feasible solution.
Congressman John Conyers of Detroit's 13th District, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Oh boy, here we go again. That's what some in Michigan are undoubtedly thinking as they learn of a proposed natural gas pipeline that could run through Michigan on its way to Ontario. The proposed Rover pipeline would carry natural gas through about 180 miles of Michigan. Some of it would track the very same route as that controversial Enbridge 6B oil pipeline that was recently replaced. Keith Matheny is a reporter for the Detroit Free Press. Keith, what would the Rover pipeline be doing?
Well, it's going to take natural gas from areas of Pennsylvania, West Virginia, and Ohio, where they've been quite successful in extracting it, including through the controversial practice of fracking. And it's going to ship it first westward across several states, where it will cut up from Ohio into Michigan through kind of the southeast corner of Michigan, spanning six counties, and ultimately ending up at a hub in Sarnia, Ontario, where it can then be distributed pretty much anywhere, probably to the East Coast, perhaps across Canada, and maybe even out of North America.
And how closely do they think the Rover would track along that route of Enbridge 6B?
Well, 6B actually comes from the west to the east, so it would only catch a portion of that route, but certainly a couple of counties in Michigan are likely to be it's going to be that same right-of-way for the people whose lives were kind of turned upside down during the Line 6B installation last year. I'm looking at like maybe Oakland, Macomb, St. Clair counties, perhaps other counties as well. It's going to be the very same people, the very same route, the people who saw their backyards torn up for a year, the people who occasionally had their roads inaccessible. It was quite a process they went through, and they're looking at it at least on a somewhat similar basis again.
And I can only imagine there's that sense of deja vu, and not in a good way for these property owners.
Absolutely. And a lot of them felt kind of helpless in the Line 6B process, because, of course, there are rights of eminent domain where essentially the companies go out and they attempt to work a deal with the property owner for fair value for the disruption that they'll cause. But basically, if you say absolutely not, I'm completely opposed to this, they can go and get a court order and essentially override you and do it. And it's looking like the same thing would be possible with this ET Rover pipeline.
Tell us about the company behind the Rover pipeline.
Well, it's a subsidiary of Energy Transfer Partners, and they're a pretty major player in petroleum product transport in North America. I think I'm going to have a story later this week. Interestingly, 2 years ago, they were arguing before the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, or FERC. They're the ultimate arbiters of these matters. And because it's multi-state, it's on a federal level. It's not a state-level decision. 2 years ago, they were arguing to abandon a major, now this was a north-south natural gas pipeline that they ultimately sold off to Enbridge to transfer oil. And in that process, they were arguing that the market wasn't particularly strong for natural gas in the Midwest, and they could still meet all of their demands, and that it was appropriate for them to be able to sell this off. 2 years later, here they are saying, we've got a strong market and need to have this new distribution route from the Marcellus and Utica shale formations in Pennsylvania and West Virginia.
Well, E.T. Rover spokesperson Vicky Granato had this to say about property owners who live along the proposed path of the Rover pipeline.
It's important to Energy Transfer that we reach out and we communicate and we meet people and we talk to them. It's also important that as we do work in these communities that we're very respectful of people's property and of all of the environmental concerns.
Well, we know so many property owners in Michigan, just as you said, Keith, had a very bruising, difficult experience with Enbridge, the Canadian firm. Do we have any idea what they might expect from Energy Transfer? Any reason for people to believe that statement that we just heard from their spokesperson?
Well, I've heard is anecdotal, so I'm not really sure if they would have a similar experience. I do know that some people were not satisfied with the level of cooperation that they got on the Line 6B process, and I know they're extremely leery that it won't be this great spirit of cooperation and where they listen and cater to individual landowners' concerns.
We have about 300,000 miles of gas pipelines in the U.S., these big, large-scale lines, not the little distribution pipelines that run to our houses. What do we know about the safety of these large-scale lines?
Well, certainly there have been some major incidents with natural gas explosions, one of the most notable being in California a couple years ago, where a number of people were killed. That often has to do with aging pipelines. Certainly this multi-state E.T. Rover proposed pipeline would be a vast pipeline. They're talking a 42-inch diameter pipe that would transport more than 3 billion cubic feet of gas per day. Now, for a little bit of perspective on that, in the highest gas demand day ever for consumers' energy, which was in January of 2013, they pushed out less natural gas across the entire state of Michigan than the amount that would pass through this pipeline every day.
That's a big pipeline.
Indeed.
And you say the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, FERC, is the ultimate decider of whether this will happen. What kind of timetable are we looking at, Keith?
This is actually on a relatively slow timetable. The folks at Energy Transfer Partners indicate that they're in sort of a pre-application process and that they expect to submit their formal application either at the end of this year or the start of next year. And then I would imagine it would take, you know, throughout 2015 to reach a decision. You know, there's certain environmental investigations that have to take place, and there's a process involved. But I believe they would like to be constructing this pipeline if they got all the approvals they needed in 2015.
Energy Transfer Partners will be holding a series of public meetings along the path of the proposed Rover pipeline. In fact, there's a meeting this evening in Chelsea from 5:30 to 7:30. It's at the Comfort Inn Village Conference Center on Commerce Park Drive in Chelsea. There's also a meeting tonight in Richmond. It'll be held at the Lois Wagner Memorial Library, again from 5:30 to 7:30. Detroit Free Press reporter Keith Matheny, always good to talk with you. Thanks so much, Keith.
Thank you, Cynthia.
The Science Fiction Spotlight is shining on Detroit this week. The Motor City will be hosting the 2014 North American Science Fiction Convention from July 17th to the 20th. Jim Hines is a fantasy novelist from Michigan. He's one of the three masters of ceremonies for the big convention known as DetCon 1. Jim, take us to DetCon 1. It's the first day. You're all there at the Detroit Marriott Renaissance Center. What's going on and who's there?
Well, you've got a convention center full of authors and fans and basically just a hotel packed full of geeks. A lot of running around, a lot of friends catching up with each other. And, of course, because you have a bunch of authors there, there will be people hanging out in the bar.
Now, tell us how this gathering differs from the comic cons that we have seen here in Southeast Michigan for many years. I know there's a huge one in Chicago where you've got, you know, Captain Kirk and Mr. Spock, and you've got the artists and the action heroes and the TV stars. How is this different?
I'd say that the big difference is a lot of the comic cons tend to be focused more on the media and the comic and the anime side of things, whereas DetCon 1 has more of a literary focus in that we're looking at the novels, the stories, and the authors. It's not that one is better or worse than the other. It's just a somewhat different focus.
I know it's called DetCon 1 because each of these conventions gets its own special name. And I noticed the website for DetCon 1, Jim, promises a true Michigan experience. What does that mean?
For starters, we'll have a lot of the Michigan fandom contingent there, a lot of Michigan authors there talking about their work, talking about the genre. And well, it's a little bit of a spoiler, but I can also tell you that we'll be doing opening ceremonies and trying to talk a bit about Michigan culture, you know, trying to explain to people what a youper is versus a troll, introducing people to the idea of Verners, all of the really important Michigan cultural things.
You have written award-winning fantasy novels and series and more than 40 published short stories. You have won a Hugo Award in 2012 for your writing. I'm wondering, what does fantasy mean to you as a writer and also someone who just loves the genre?
Oh, great question. I have been a fantasy fit. Well, no. I've been a geek for pretty much as long as I can remember. And I think what I love about science fiction and fantasy especially is the possibility, the sense of wonder, that there are no rules, there are no limits. And whether it's reading or creating the story, those moments that you just get to ask, well, what if this, and run with an idea and create that sense of wonder, there's nothing like it.
Now, I understand you're working on a fantasy series set in northern Michigan?
I am. The first book was called Libriomancer. It is about a librarian from the UP who has the ability, he can reach into books and pull out anything that fits through the pages. So he gets to run around with laser blasters or lightsabers or whatever it takes. And over the course of the series, he fights vampires and werewolves and, well, I don't want to spoil anything, but he is helped by a pet spider who sets things on fire and a dryad who runs around with a pair of wooden swords. It's been a lot of fun being able to work in some of the Michigan landmarks. I've gotten a lot of reader response from people who live in Michigan who have been really excited to see, oh, the Mackinac Bridge or Fort Michilimackinac or, hey, this scene's over on MSU's campus, and it's just been a blast.
The 2014 North American Science Fiction Convention, running from July 17th through the 20th, it's at the Detroit Marriott Renaissance Center. And you can get all kinds of details at their website. It's DetCon1.org. And we should note that's the number one, not the word, DetCon1.org. And we've been talking with Michigan fantasy writer and master of ceremonies for DetCon 1, Jim Hines. Thanks so much, Jim.
Thank you, Cindy.
Surfing in Michigan? You bet. Turns out good surfing isn't found just on the north shore of Oahu or along the California coast. Try Lake Michigan. Ella Scrocky is with us now from Empire, where she's a surf instructor at Sleeping Bear Surf and Kayak. Hi, Ella.
Hello.
How good is the surfing on Lake Michigan?
It's great. You know, as compared to the ocean, it's not as consistent, but, you know, here on the lakes, we get really, really wonderful swell, like, through the fall is even greater than right now. But, you know, we get these, like, beautiful, beautiful summer days where we actually all get to be in the water, too, and that's pretty special.
What makes it so good?
I think mainly it's the fact that because it's so inconsistent, we have these very rare days where everybody gets really hyped up and we have a kind of teeny tiny community here, and everyone gets to connect with each other, and we all get each other excited on being on the water because it's been so long since our last swell or anything like that. So it's really that infrequency that makes it so special.
And it really, it has to do with what the wind is doing, and then from there you're able to get enough of a swell to surf?
Exactly. Yep. You know, mainly how we get waves on here on the lakes is through like giant cold pressure cells or low pressure cells. So normally it's days where beachgoers are hiding away in their homes. So you get these giant storms in that bring in on and offshore winds, and that creates waves.
And makes you very happy.
Yes, it does.
Do you need different equipment then to surf our cold salt free lake compared to what you might do? I know some of your other spots you've gone are Costa Rica and Ecuador and California.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, here on the lakes, compared to, I mean, let's say California, they do have cold water there. So a wetsuit is always really smart on the lake. Sometimes there's summer days where we can surf in board shorts and a bikini, but you know, all year round, I'm wearing at least like a 4.3, and that's what makes me comfortable.
Wait, you're wearing a, what is it?
It's a 4 mil suit. Yeah, sometimes I'll wear a 3 mil suit midsummer, but this summer the water temperature has been so cold that a 4 mil suit is really nice to have. So that's like almost half a centimeter thick.
Alec, give us an idea. When is surfing season in Michigan?
Surfing season is mainly in the fall. So the best waves that we get, especially here in northern Michigan, are late September through like late November. Then you get into the winter surfing season where if the lake isn't frozen over, that's really awesome as well because we've got cold water and a little warmer air. But the fall season is our best season for surf.
What are some of your favorite spots to surf when you're thinking of surfing Lake Michigan?
Well, it all depends on the wind direction, but like here close to home, I really love Frankfurt. Normally Frankfurt goes on a south-southwest, and then Leland also is really fun. It's a steeper, heavier wave than we get in Frankfurt, but it's still really great on a north. And I actually fell in love with surfing Marquette this last year. I went up there for school, and there's a spot that we all call the zoo, which is actually... It's an ironic name because it's really wild out there. The waves kind of wrap in around this point and come in through this bay and get really big and heavy, but they're like giant, really peaceful monsters. So that actually became one of my favorite spots, and I've had some sessions out there that I'll remember until the day I die.
Wow, sounds awesome. Thanks for talking with us. Ella Scrocky is a surf instructor at Sleeping Bear Surf and Kayak in Empire. You can find out more at their website, sbsurfandkayak.com, all spelled out, sbsurfandkayak.com. Ella, thanks so much. Have a great summer.
Thank you so much. Enjoy.
And in case you're near Empire next week, Ella and the Sleeping Bear Surf and Kayak Store are hosting a freshwater surf camp. That's next week, the 21st through the 25th, and you can get details at sbsurfandkayak.com. And we always want to hear from you. What is your favorite spot on Lake Michigan, or really any of the other Great Lakes for that matter? Let us know. Find us on Facebook, search for Stateside with Cynthia Canty. We're on Twitter at Stateside Radio, and as always, michiganradio.org, and click the link that says Stateside. Also here, a correction from a story we aired yesterday about Michigan abolitionist Laura Haviland. We said Laura was from Albion. Well, she's actually from Adrian in Lenawee County. We want to thank our web readers, Stephen and Marilyn, for pointing this out to us. Welcome back to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. There are jobs going begging in Michigan. Good, well-paying jobs. And if we don't find new ways to teach the right skills and train more workers, Michigan is going to be hurt. That's what Bridge magazine writer Ted Roloffs heard from top business leaders as he explored the skilled labor shortage in Michigan. His piece for Bridge is called Help Wanted. Yes, there really are 70,000 good jobs open. Ted, 70,000? Because that really goes against the popular view that it's hard to find a good job in Michigan.
Yeah, and it is surprising, but it doesn't take a lot of effort to find employers that are frustrated in their ability to attract and keep the kind of workers and workers with the skills that they need to their businesses. And it's not just isolated to one or two; it's scattered across the state in a variety of job skills and occupations.
Give us an idea of the kinds of skills and occupations that we're talking about.
Well, you know, it's a much bigger range than you might expect. I mean, all the way from various types of engineers, software engineers, production engineers, various construction skills. I reported earlier on a shortage that is still there, truck drivers. People in advanced manufacturing seems to be a particular problem, kind of manufacturing that requires more than just walking in the door with no knowledge whatsoever. The kind of precision manufacturing connected to the automobile industry, that's an ongoing difficulty that a lot of firms are reporting.
And you also note in your piece that if someone wanted to be a nurse, it sure seems like a good time to do it.
Yeah, and that's, you know, what I've heard in the healthcare field is that is not so much an acute problem today, but it is expected to be much more so within perhaps, I don't know, 4 to 6 years. What you've got is this kind of double thing happening. You've got baby boom nurses retiring, and you've got a projected increased demand for nursing as the population ages, and that all makes sense. As people get older, there's more healthcare needs, but you've got people, nurses leaving the workforce. So that combination in tandem is going to present a problem within a few years.
So the question arises, why is this? And I'm wondering, are Michigan schools pushing too many kids into the go get a four-year bachelor's degree track and ignoring those kids who might be really good at shop or drafting that would give them the kind of skills that are begging?
I think it's a valid point. I spoke with President and CEO of AutoCam in Kentwood, John Kennedy. He's been involved in this issue in a hands-on way for quite a long time. He's got a precision automotive business. The problem he's having is that he cannot get enough of the kind of skilled manufacturing workers that he needs. So he actually developed a program in tandem with Grand Rapids Community College to take appropriately qualified applicants into an apprenticeship program. They work at the plant, but they're also paid to go to school to learn the kinds of abilities in math and reading and dimensions and so forth that they need to do the job. And when they're finished with that program, I think they start in at 13 an hour while they're getting the schoolwork. When they're done, they're making $17.50 an hour or more. And he tells me the average W-2 form for a production worker at his plant is something like $52,000 a year because they do a lot of overtime. The problem that he sees is that you've got kids in high school, and they're probably kids that could do this work, but they're either not interested or they're not being reached by the classes that high schools offer. They don't see the relevance of the math class, that the math class might lead to this job. And that's where the disconnect is. So, and that's a lot of workers. He told me that they had 20 openings they could fill today if the right workers walked in the door.
And you actually heard something rather important and, dare I say, ominous from John Kennedy of AutoCam. He said they don't have any problem finding those workers for their operation in China.
Absolutely. And it's a frustration, I think, because he sees it's not only, I guess, from a quote-unquote selfish business standpoint that he needs these workers, but he would like kids out there that have the potential to do this kind of thing have the opportunity to plug into it. So it's a matter of kind of somehow bridging that disconnect. And, you know, maybe part of it, too, is that kids at that age today maybe don't aspire to that kind of work because they think that's yesterday's job. But as he indicated, you can make a good living at that. And I'm sure there's a lot of high school students right now, 15, 16 years old, that maybe, you know, they have natural hands-on ability, but they're not seeing, oh, why do I care about this math class? And that's the connection that has to be made.
You also point out, you talk about a study in West Michigan demand that there will be a demand for 38,000 additional workers with four-year college degrees by 2025. So it sounds like we're not saying that a four-year college degree isn't useful, but it's the right kind of degree.
Exactly. Yeah, there's no one-size-fits-all prescription or answer for this. It's nuanced in a way because these job openings are not the same across the board, and there's no guarantee, as we know, that if you get any kind of four-year college degree, no matter what, you're going to be able to get a good job. There has to be the right fit. So four-year college degree, definitely a need for more of that, but also, on the other hand, a need for high schools to do a better job to reach students that have potential in manufacturing and perhaps other related fields so they can see the relevance of that and come out of high school, you know, with the kind of skill and ability that, that these employers can use.
Isn't that the area where we probably have seen cuts, the shop or the drafting classes, the ones that would kind of start them on that road?
Absolutely. I think that happened a long time ago, and you know, you've heard a lot of people say that we need to restore that, and that certainly makes a lot of sense. My general sense of, if you look over, I've heard this for years, if you look over a country like Germany, where they establish kind of a dual track for students when they're relatively young, so they've got a pretty rigorous system of vocational training for their workers, and I think as a result they're among the leading, if not the leading, advanced manufacturing country in the world.
Well, we know it's not a problem that's going unnoticed by our leaders, because Governor Snyder was talking about it last month at the Mackinac Policy Conference. What are the thoughts as far as the solution to this shortage?
Well, I don't know if there's a magical answer, push a button at the state level, and this is what we can do. I think the kind of program that that AutoChem helped develop in West Michigan in concert with Grand Rapids Community College, and there's a similar program in Southeast Michigan where a number of employers are connected with community college training programs, very similar to the kind of program that's underway at Grand Rapids Community College. So that's a good start. And beyond that, I think employers have to just be creative in how they reach out, how they attract workers, and do what they can to retain them, so they're not going to be looking elsewhere.
And if we don't find a way to fix this disconnect, what do you hear from the business leaders? What would this mean ultimately for Michigan?
Well, I think what you're really talking about is missed opportunities for economic growth. I mean, it makes sense that if there's a firm that could bring on 20, 30, 4 more workers, if they could find the qualified workers, and if you don't do that, if you can't fill those slots, you're missing out on economic growth.
Ted Roloff's piece in Bridge is entitled "Help Wanted." Yes, there really are 70,000 good jobs open. Thanks so much, Ted.
You bet.
Michigan spends nearly $2 billion a year on corrections. That means we pump more money into prisons than into higher education. And Michigan keeps its prisoners behind bars longer than the national average. Both liberal and conservative voices are asking, are we getting a safer state for all that money? Are there different approaches to prisons and corrections that could offer answers? My next guest recently wrote a piece for Next City that could shed some light on those questions. Its title, Can Europe Offer the U.S. a Model for Prison Reform? Christopher Moreff joins us now. Welcome.
Thanks for having me, Cindy.
You dive into the approaches specifically taken in Germany and the Netherlands to corrections and to prisons. Can you tell us basically the fundamental difference in the primary goal of corrections in Germany and the Netherlands compared to here in the U.S.?
Sure. So in the Netherlands and in Germany, there is more of an effort to re-socialize offenders back into society. So the purpose of corrections is much more rehabilitative and, diverting people into the community, whereas U.S. corrections is very incarceration-focused in both the sentencing side and the way people are treated after they're convicted and once they're in jail in Europe, specifically in Germany and the Netherlands. There are many more alternatives to incarceration that are explored. So there's a much greater use of fines and diversion. Much fewer inmates actually wind up in prison, but also what happens to them there is much different. The focus is on normalization. So in neither of those countries, in Germany or the Netherlands, is the sole purpose of incarceration to protect society. That's written in law. There is an effort to create a normalized set of circumstances to mimic community life as much as possible to re-socialize offenders for when they are ultimately released, which 95% of offenders in America and in Europe will eventually be.
Well, then, for the inmates who are behind bars in Germany and the Netherlands, describe for us how the actual prisons and the life of the inmates differ from your typical U.S. prison. First, mm-hmm. the design of the prisons.
Sure. Well, now, I should preface that the information I'm giving you now is from a 2013 report from the Vera Institute of Justice, who coordinated a trip with corrections officials from Pennsylvania, Colorado, and Georgia, a nine-day trip to a fact-finding trip to these countries. So, first of all, the layout of prisons are much different. I mean, to quote one source who was on the trip, it felt more college dormitory than what we think of as a penitentiary. There's a much more liberal use of what they call open facilities over there, which allow at least some limited interaction with the community, either through work release or family visits. Inmates are allowed to wear their own clothes. They are allowed to decorate their own cells. Guards knock before they enter. So there's an attempt to at least instill a sense of privacy and humanity. Because when you dehumanize somebody, again, if we make the goal resocialization, dehumanization is not the right way to go about that. Mm. And I think one of the most important things that I've learned is that prisoners in Europe are allowed to vote the entire time they're in prison, which is telling. It's an example of wanting people to be engaged in their community. When you go to jail in America, that's not the case. And in fact, some felons have to fight for their right to vote when they get out.
Hmm. And the idea that weekend home visits are a possibility and keeping the family connections close, it seems that the philosophy is that is very, very important in lowering recidivism.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, the data has played this out. I mean, people that are engaged in their communities and with their families are much more likely to be rehabilitated. Those kinds of intimate connections are an important part of society and of socializing somebody away from a criminal past. And yeah, so there are weekend visits with family. It's almost like sort of a reverse work release program, as one source described it to me. And it's actually something that at least this particular source in Colorado thinks could work here with some lower level offenders.
Tell us about the staff at these Dutch and German prisons and how they differ from the U.S. In terms of what they are and their training.
Yeah, so for the most part, people that are, you know, employed in these facilities or in correctional positions have a background either in the law, in mental health, in counseling. So they've been trained with the types of skills that will allow them to impart a therapeutic message to the people that they oversee. They're not just people guards, you know, just there to keep people from fighting or, you know, make sure everybody's there with a head count. I mean, there's a level of professionalism and a level of training that goes with this that is unlike anything that we have in America, and that there is a push since this trip in at least Pennsylvania and Colorado to sort of instill some of these conflict resolution skills and counseling skills into the CO population. It's not like we can go through and replace everyone with, you know, with an attorney or something.
Or a social
point,
worker, yeah.
Exactly, but they, at least Colorado and Pennsylvania, have both started programs to sort of retrain some of their facility staff on the skills that they need. So again, it goes back to this idea of limiting the adversarial relationship between inmate and guard. I mean, when you put somebody into a very bleak, sort of like controlled environment, you know, a microcosm that is adversarial and you know, and dark and cold and not anything like the community, and then you expect to release them back into the community and behave themselves, it just seems counterintuitive, and I think Europe has figured that out.
I'm speaking with writer Christopher Moreff, whose piece in Next City asks the question, can Europe offer the U.S. a model for prison reform? And you just touched on this, Christopher. You were saying not all European prisons are this way. I happen to know England's and Ireland's, for instance. Those countries have some pretty grim lockups. So this is not Europe across the board, is it?
Right. It's again, we're dealing with two very specific progressive countries. And I can't speak individually to
sure.
say Spain or Italy or places like that. But like you said, yes. I mean, in Ireland and the UK, I mean, they're much more reflective of our model of corrections. But there are progressive, forward-thinking countries that have been doing this. I mean, Germany's prison law was written, I believe, in the 70s, and the Netherlands has been incorporating fines for a majority of offenses. Even murder technically could have a fine. There is the discretion to have that since the 80s. So, we're not talking about changes that were just made. I mean, they've had success with this over the years.
And how has this therapeutic approach versus punishment, how has that affected recidivism rates and crime rates in Germany and the Netherlands?
Yeah, that's a tricky question to answer because recidivism is really hard to measure across jurisdictions. Things that, for instance, we may see like a technical parole violation as a reoffense, whereas in the Germany and the Netherlands, like that might not be counted as necessarily a reoffense. So being able to match the recidivism rates is tough. But there is a culture of the culture around criminal justice in both those countries. There is more of a shame attached to prison and to committing crimes, and people do tend to be more likely to reenter the community and not reoffend.
An interesting piece from writer Christopher Moraff. It's in Next City, and it's entitled, Can Europe Offer the U.S. a Model for Prison Reform? Christopher, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Oh, thanks for having me, Cindy.
Tomorrow on Stateside, a new approach to juvenile justice is paying off in Berrien County.
Our belief is that kids live in an ecology. That ecology is their family system, their neighborhood, their community, their school, and we needed to impact those areas to help youth be successful in our communities.
Keeping teens out of prison, next time on Stateside. Today's Stateside was directed by Mercedes Mejia. Our executive producer is Zoe Clark. Stateside was engineered today by Bob Scon. Contributors are Allie Billings, Emily Fox, Taylor Mattia, Omar Saade, Kayla Steinberg, Katie Suha, and Brianna Tinsley. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.